This is the Biz News Podcast, one-on-one conversations with experts in business and personal development.
Dave Richards went from a lifetime in the military to becoming a business professional, yoga instructor, poet, and author. His childhood was spent in various parts of the U.S. as well as Japan as a military dependent, and he joined the Marines after graduating from Penn State with a degree in English. Mr. Richards says he believes that every human has untapped reservoirs of imagination within them, as if everyone had a god inside themselves. David Richards talks about his discoveries and his books in this edition of Biz News Interviews. Dave, before we find out a little bit more about you, there's a very provocative thing that you have said that I'd like to get you to expand on, and that is that you believe we all have a god inside us. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I just launched my most recent book, Love Letters to the Virgin Mary, The Resurrection of King David. And it draws on kind of just where we are in our time in human history. And we're in this fascinating point where we have just created the first wormhole. Scientists created the first wormhole about 2 weeks ago. We had this breakthrough that the United States government announced with fusion energy, where we were able to produce more energy than was needed to create the energy, which is fantastic. And Google right now is working on a quantum computer that within the next 2 years will be able to solve problems that our best computers now could not solve in a trillion years. So you have to ask yourself, what does that mean for us as a species? What benefit we see when we have computers that can solve problems that we couldn't even fathom solving before? And certainly with my understanding and diving into quantum physics, I've just come around to this idea that we all have a god inside us, and it's up to us to find out and sculpt that identity for ourselves. But ultimately, that is the destination that I see for humanity.
You haven't gotten quite down to string theory, I guess, then.
I've dabbled with string theory, but I am not an expert by any stretch of the imagination.
How did your background, which I'd like you to enumerate for our viewers and listeners, affect you in reaching that conclusion?
It's a great question to start with. I grew up in the military. So my dad was in the Marines. He served 31 years. And so I grew up on military bases up and down the East Coast, as well as we spent 3 years in Japan when I was a little kid. And so getting exposed to Eastern philosophy and Eastern culture at an impressionable age had a tremendous impact on me. And I came back to the United States and realized that no one else in my class had had that experience, really. And in some ways it was beautiful because I had that experience, but in some ways it also made me stand out because so few people, you know, no one really had that experience. And I was always very romantic and always, I started writing poetry to girls when I was probably 10. And that just really called to me to get into creative writing and things like that. And so I had some success when I was in high school. I got some things published. I had some poetry that won contests. But when it came time to kind of grow up, it was, okay, if you get an academic scholarship, that's a great way to pay for college. Otherwise, you want to look at ROTC or going into the military. And so my grades weren't good enough to be academically rewarded. So I joined ROTC. That led me to the Marine Corps. And even though I was an English major in college, I kind of divorced myself from the idea that I was going to write professionally. I wanted to be the next Stephen King. I really loved his work and was just amazed on the journeys that he could take people. So I joined the Marines, was in the combat arms, was in Somalia as part of Operation Restore Hope in ancient history way back in the 90s. But there was always a part of myself that I couldn't completely satisfy, and it was this artistic, creative side of me. And so about 10 years into my military career, I started writing poetry again. And in the Marine Corps, that will raise some eyebrows because a lot of Marines don't associate Marines with poetry. And then I made the decision after 15 years to get out. And part of it was I realized the blueprint that I'd been using for my life was very much my dad's. And that came about because I didn't really know any better, because in the military, you don't really, you don't spend a lot of time thinking about yourself. I mean, it's just not the culture of the military is to think externally and focus on things outside of you. So I made that decision. I immediately fell in love with yoga, which wasn't part of my plan, but that led me down this path. And yoga is really the stepping stone that I attribute getting me into quantum physics, because the whole premise behind yoga is there's something more behind you or more to you than this body and this mind. And you can call that soul, you can call that spirit, but my journey into yoga led me down that path. And that led me to quantum physics, and quantum physics kind of upends Newtonian physics and says that we have an impact on our reality. And so our thoughts and feelings can shape our reality. And I found that really fascinating. And after 11 years of trying to write horror stories, after I got out of the military, I finally wrote a self-help book on helping people find their purpose. And that opened up the door to just continue to dive deeper into who am I and how can I contribute to the world.
What did the men, and I presume women, that you commanded think of their yoga leader?
Well, I didn't teach or even practice yoga while I was in the Marines. I don't think I could have pointed out.
Well, perhaps I should have said the poet leader.
I had people ask me if I was gay. That was something that came out. And it wasn't, I didn't interpret it as a, like, they just, I mean, that was sort of the visceral response that it elicited. When I remember telling one of my colleagues, and he said, "Are you gay?" And I was just like, "No, I just, like, if you read my poetry, you'll see it's pretty, you know, I wrote about Achilles. I wrote just strong stuff. A lot of it was romantic, but it raised eyebrows. And again, it's just because you just don't see that in the Marine Corps. And I, like, even through my Marine Corps career, part of what got me back into writing poetry was I had a boss, and this guy was a tough as nails colonel. He was a military police officer. He'd been a Boston street cop before he joined the Marines, so he was really tough. But he painted, and he had paintings in his office. And I remember going into his office, and I was just blown away that here was another Marine who had an artistic side to him. And it was fascinating to me. But for me, that was a license to start to explore poetry. And I remember we were talking, there was a miniseries coming on TV about Helen of Troy. And I said, "Oh, you know, we both agreed it probably wouldn't be as savage as, like, you know, we would like it to be like Brad Pitt's Troy movie kind of." But I said, "You know what? I'm going to write a poem about Achilles." And that was my first entry point into doing that. But it was both a blessing and a curse. It got me into one of my advanced master's degree programs, because for the application, my instructor that I was reporting to submitted some of my poetry to the admittance board. But also it made me stand out, because just poetry wasn't something you heard Marine officers doing a lot of.
Poetry is not exactly known as a lucrative career path either.
It's not. Certainly. And I don't believe I harbored any illusions that I was going to become rich writing poetry, but it was a path for me to create. And for me, that was deeply satisfying. That satisfied me on a spiritual level that I couldn't really express. I remember one time I was in a Jiffy Lube getting the oil changed in my car, and I just had this inspiration for a poem come to me. So I grabbed a newspaper and I just wrote the poem on the fringe of the newspaper. And I was like, that, but that's kind of the flow I was in terms of that time in my life.
So as you have studied quantum physics, where do you think that fits in with religion and the idea of God?
Yeah, well, so the whole premise behind quantum physics is that there is a, you know, it's all around us. We're all entangled. There's quantum entanglement. And the classic model of physics, Newtonian physics, is that we experience time through space. In other words, if I want to go for a 3-mile run, I know that's going to take me about 24, 25 minutes, and it will take me that long to cover that amount of distance. Well, in quantum physics, there is no separation in time and space, really. It's all what's possible. And we know now, where Newtonian physics, we used to think the atom was a solid piece of matter, we now know that the atom is 99.9999% empty space. And there's only 0.00001% that's actually particle. And so when you think of that in terms of God, one of the most fascinating kind of explorations or discoveries I've made during this time is you go back and you read Napoleon Hill, who wrote Think and Grow Rich, or you read Neville Goddard. And Hill in particular talks with Henry Ford. He talks with Dale Carnegie, I think Andrew Carnegie, and how amazing and how simply they talk about infinite intelligence and the accessibility of infinite intelligence. And when you think about what quantum physics represents and this idea that there is no real separation, it's only the separation that we observe and we create, then you start to get to the idea that infinite intelligence is in the quantum. And if you want to call that God, then that's where I would go with it.
How did that factor into conceiving of your newest book and the writing of it?
Yeah, so the initial inspiration for this book came about in October of 2019. I was just getting out of a relationship, and it was a fascinating time because this is obviously pre-pandemic or right at the kind of almost right at the beginning of the pandemic. And there was this fascination with social media. And I remember seeing at the time when I was studying and for one of my earlier books that people were checking their smartphones on average about 85 times a day. And now that number's gone up, I want to say it's around 110 or 120 times a day, but it's like every 6 to 10 minutes, people are checking their phones. And I was just like, you could go into a Starbucks and you could just see everyone in line had their head down and their phone up. Or the same, if you go to a fast food, you know, Chipotle or wherever, you saw the same phenomena. And part of my curiosity was, to what end? If we have more than 3 billion devices, or half the planet has smartphones, what does it mean if we're all becoming addicted to this device, this outboard brain, if you will? And the initial inspiration for the book, the idea for the book was going to be called Being, B-E-I-N-G. And it was this idea that who we are is more important than what we do, but what we do is always constantly shaping who we are. And so the idea was, if you can focus on who you are, who you want to become, and create a compelling version of yourself in the future, then you will start to organize yourself in a way that you get to do, and you need to do the right things in order to become that version of yourself. In other words, the things that aren't serving you and aren't helping you move towards that version of yourself in the future will start to melt away. And that could be people, it could be bad habits you have, whatever the case may be. And so I was in the process of promoting my second book, which was just coming out in March of 2020. And I kind of wasn't feeling like I was in a place where I could write this book, like I could give it my full attention. But at the same time, I was really proud of my second book and I wanted to challenge myself a little bit. So I entered a crowdfunding contest in January to get this idea out. And so I had to do a video, and I don't remember how many people I got, but I had about, I think, a dozen publishers that were interested. And I went to a Jack Canfield mastermind in Santa Barbara, California. And this was in late March. So the pandemic had already spread, and about only a third of us went to the mastermind with Jack. And we talked a little bit about my old book, but we also talked about this book. And I came back from that mastermind, and Jack had provided me some great insights. And I sat down the following weekend, because I was supposed to go to Florida for something, but that got canceled. So I sat down the following weekend and I wrote the first chapter. And then I thought, you know what? I'm not going to do this conventionally. And I'd written the first chapter on my Mac. It was 27 pages, I remember. It was a very good, it was almost like the opening argument of a lawyer presenting his case. It was still this idea about being and doing. And the next weekend, I said, I'm not going to do that. And I grabbed a notebook and I grabbed two different colored pens. And I started this conversation between these two different pens. And one pen became the voice of conditional love. And the other voice became the pen of unconditional love. And as the pandemic began to really kind of settle into across the world, I had this spiritual transformation. I was doing some meditations from Dr. Joe Dispenza, who, from what my observation is, he has done the most work in kind of really getting clear on what the quantum field is and how to manifest the life of your dreams from the quantum field. He's got tons of meditations and his books. I really resonate with what he's talked about. And as the journey began to unfold for me, the book started to get more detail and more texture to it. And I kept rewriting every weekend. I was working during the week. And then every weekend I was rewriting what was basically the outline of the book. And it started to get more texture. And I saw a picture of a woman on Instagram. So it goes back to the whole social media thing. And that picture stirred something within me. And it also set me on this weird course because I decided that I was going to include that picture into the story. And that took place over the next year and a half. I was trying to figure out just how to tell the story and even come up with a title. And so I started, the idea came in October of 2019. I did not come up with a title until November of 2021. And then I finished, that allowed me to finish the first draft. I wrote the first draft in all of December of last year. I finished it New Year's Day this year.
So that then brings us to one thing we like to talk to authors about is what is your writing routine? Are you like Hemingway, where you grind out 5,000 words before noon and then disappear into a bar? Not that you would, but it sets an example for some of us at least, or what?
My writing and practice has evolved tremendously. And just to put it in context, when I started, I guess probably 2 years after getting out of the Marines, I had this sense that I could start writing because I wasn't, for the first time in my life, I wasn't moving every 3 years and I knew I was going to be in one place. And that kind of stability and just getting to know an area without the idea that my time here was going to be transitory started to transform me. And so I started to have inspiration about, okay, I can write about stories that take place in where I live. But unfortunately for me, my writing was so infantile at that point where I felt like if I'm sitting down to write, it's going to be beautiful. Like everything it's going to be masterful. And that wasn't the case. And so for 11 years, I struggled to write a horror story. And then I read Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich in 2016, Christmas time. And in that book, he says, what is the purpose of your life? And I was blown away because I just never thought about my life having a purpose and having a compass that I could tune into. So I divorced myself from the idea of becoming a horror writer and said, I'm going to write a book about helping people find their purpose in life. And again, I was just in this idea that if I'm writing, it must be worth printing. And that made writing my first book such a struggle. And then after that, I started to realize that part of the challenge for any writer is the propensity to edit themselves. And so I read a great book called Writing Down the Bones. And in that, there's a great technique that the author teaches you. And it's take a timer on your phone, set it for 5 minutes, grab a pen and paper. And when the timer goes, just start writing and don't let the pen come off the page and just write and see what comes out. Don't edit yourself. Don't worry about margin. Don't worry about spelling, no punctuation. And I remember the first time I did it, my first sentence was like, this feels weird that I'm doing this. It feels a little strange. And then after 5 minutes, the timer went off and I had like 4 or 5 pages of material. And I was blown away because I was like, where did that come from? So to kind of fast forward, I still didn't have a great writing practice when I wrote my second book. For this book, for Love Letters, I wrote the outline. I wrote probably 5 versions of the outline. Each one was about 100 pages of text conversation kind of. And then I got to a point where I couldn't really figure out how to tell the story. And so for the next year and a half during the pandemic, I journaled trying to chip away at what this story was. And it was finally probably in September of 2021 that I wrote about 6 pages in journal, and it felt like this is content that I can use in the book. Like this is substance that I have. And that was really exciting to me because I'd progressed so much. And what I came to realize was writing, like anything, is a discipline and a practice, and you have to do it repetitively. And so now I have journals all around my house. I will journal at the drop of a dime. When I wrote the first draft of Love Letters, I took the month of December off last year, I would go to the gym and work out in the morning. I would do a little meditation, and then I would write for about 3 hours. And I would kind of have the sense of when I'd spent myself for the day, whether it was 20 pages or 30 pages or whatever. But I was so happy just because I had a direction for the story and I knew it was going to go somewhere. And that seemed to work out for me. I would spend, you know, 3 hours. I did not go to a bar like Hemingway did afterwards. But I would use, you know, 3 or 4 hours mostly and get the writing in. And then I finished it New Year's Day. I went away for about 3 months just to decompress from what I'd written, and then started to tinker with what the second draft was going to be after that.
Did you ever use a professional editor?
I did use an editor. I also used a proofer, and that is invaluable because it's so great to get someone's perspective on the story and just get a different view on it. In this case, the proofer paid off more than the editor because I felt confident that the direction I had taken the story was pretty strong. Like, I would have, not that I would have had a hard time being convinced, but the editor would have had to have something really compelling to come at me with and say, I think you should change this. And that just didn't happen. The proofer found about 300 things that need to be changed, I think, the first time around. So that was useful. But that's been a journey too as well, Doug. I didn't have a great editing experience with my first book. I remember my second book, I had a meeting with my editor on Independence Day, July 4th, 2019. And he very casually said, this is what's wrong with your book. And I was just like, it was my first real editorial crush. I was like, how dare you? What are you talking about? But he was right. And we talked through it for about 20 minutes. And we came up with kind of a new angle. And that made the story that much better. So I was really pleased with it. I was grateful that Love Letters didn't need a big swift change to it based on where it ended up. So
is there yet another book on the drawing board?
I do have an idea for a follow-up to Love Letters, a sequel, if you will. The working title right now is The Silence That Whispered, but I'm going to stick with that through the new year and see if it sticks with me.
One of your other books is, I understand it, I may have the title wrong, is Whiskey and Yoga, or maybe it's Yoga and Whiskey.
Whiskey and Yoga.
Oh, I had it right the first time. Is that a textbook sort of thing?
So that was my first book, and that's really about helping people find their purpose in life. It's really a series of short, almost vignettes, if you will, just different ideas to understand how to really get that clarity on what your purpose is so that you can move forward to have not only a life that's fulfilling for you, but one that also contributes to other people.
Dave, we had one of the most wide-ranging interviews in recent months in talking with you, but what would you like to add that I have not been bright enough to ask you?
The best thing I would say to your audience, Doug, is to remember that life happens for you. It doesn't happen to you. And if you feel like you're stuck in life or you feel like you have a victim mindset, just change your perspective on life and ask yourself, why is life happening for me or unfolding for me this way? And when you do that, you'll be amazed at how much your life will shift.
And one last thing, and that is, how can people get in touch with you?
So my website is davidrichardsauthor.com. You can go there, check out Love Letters to the Virgin Mary. It is on sale. The Kindle version is on sale through the holidays for 99 cents. My other books are available there too. I am on social media at David Richards Author. If you look for me on Facebook, look under Lifting the Hammer. I won't give too much away about the story, but it ties into Love Letters. So,
you've been watching the Biz News Podcast. We welcome your input. Send your email to editor@biznews.com. Thanks for watching.